And the problem basically lies with golfers who manage their golf swing by trying to manage actions. That does not work. Golfers have to manage the interactions that occur in the components of the swing. What matters most in the golf swing, Fred, are not the components taken separately. It's the interactions. It's the product of these interactions. And these interactions actually occur. Some are visual, some are not. Some are hidden forces and pressures that exist within the body. So swing is very relative to the golfer himself. What golfers' most important takeaway from this interview is that golfers need to focus not on actions, but on interactions.
Golf Smarter number 782. The Science of Rethinking, Relearning, and Revamping Your Golf Swing with Dr. James Raganay.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing stories, tips, and insights from great golf minds to help you lower your score and raise your golf IQ. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, James.
Thank you, Fred. Thanks for the invitation.
It's my pleasure. I'm fascinated to talk about your new book, Your Inner Golf Guru, Developing the Golf Instructor Within. But I want to remind the Golf Smarter community that you've been on the podcast before many, many years ago, to the fact that it was actually episode 85. So it has returned to Golf Smarter Mulligans as episode 30. Your first book was called Golf's Three Noble Truths. Let's do a quick recap of that book before we get deep into this one.
Okay. The subtitle of Three Noble Truths was The Fine Art of Playing Awake. The word bud in Sanskrit means to wake up. So the gist of that entire book was for golfers to pay attention, to wake up. And the Three Noble Truths in traditional Buddhist theology, there were four noble truths. Which I won't go into, but this book has identified three noble truths which apply to golfers. One is balance. Second is unity. And the third is awareness. Awareness is really the core of what that book is all about. If you don't pay attention to what you're doing, you can never resolve your diet, your finances, or anything else. The only thing that you can change are the things you're aware of. So that book is all about nourishing one's awareness. It was adopted by coaches who worked with Mickelson, Justin Rose, DJ Trahan, and Steve Elkington. So It made some noise. But this is a very different book. This is not a philosophical, spiritual approach. This is a hardcore scientific approach. And it deals with how golfers can rethink, relearn, and revamp their swing based on, basically two, it's like a dumbbell approach or barbell approach, right? On one end of the bar, you have cognitive neuroscience. And the other end of the bar, you have systems thinking. The main one, I think, is systems thinking. Cognitive neuroscience, when we talk about that, will help one learn things more effectively, how the brain and the muscles and the mind interact, the integration of mind, muscle, and brain. But systems theory is really probably the most important aspect of this book. It's the part of golf instruction that is missing.
Do I have many places to go with this. So I just find it interesting that you call the book Your Inner Golf Guru, but you say it's pure science. You are a PhD. So what is your specialty?
My specialty is rhetoric and communication, but my doctoral work was in the theoretical frameworks of great scientific thinkers, how they made their breakthroughs. Their iconoclastic, different viewpoints that led them to remarkable discoveries. And I talk about I wrote about Einstein, Mendeleev, who developed the table of elements. I talked about Copernicus, Newton, and many others. So I was interested from a scientific standpoint at Rensselaer Polytech on how scientists thought. God bless you.
Thank you. Well, what does that have to do with golf? I did sneeze, but I was off microphone, so thank you for that.
Well, so
why are you tying this into golf?
Well, because golfers need to pay attention to a new mode of thinking. It's a new mode of thinking that originated with science. When Newton published his Laws of Motion in 1687, since that time, many things have changed. However, people have not changed their thinking relative to subsequent discoveries. And in maybe the mid-90s, right, there was an article in the New York Times, a startling article, which talked about a change of age thinking, an intellectual shift that was occurring that basically revolutionized everything, an intellectual shift, a paradigm shift in thinking. It had not happened since the Renaissance. So this is like a major, major shift. And this new thinking is applicable to golfers. If golfers hope to improve, they won't advance far beyond what they already are unless they change their mode of thinking. And that's what I wish to talk about, spend some time talking about. And that's systems theory, primarily. To put it another way, Fred, what this article in New York Times suggested, it was a wake-up call. It reminded me that things have gotten far more complex than they have ever been before. And in order to make thought consonant with complexity, you have to change your thinking. Old ways, traditional ways, Newtonian ways of thinking, linear thinking, reductionistic thinking, doesn't work. It doesn't work when applied to a golf swing, because a golf swing is a very complex motion. It's complex, Fred, because first of all, it's compressed into 1.4 seconds. That makes it highly difficult to fathom. It also involves 600 muscles, 360 joints, and 206 bones. So every part of your body holistically is going on when you swing a club. Swing a club is an exercise in chaos control. That's why golfers swing with such trepidation. I'm not sure what's going to happen. In Homer Kelly's book, The Golfing Machine, which has gotten both rave reviews and harsh criticism, a mathematician did a calculation on what Homer Kelly posited in his book. Homer Kelly said that there were 24 components. He originally had, I think, identified 13, 14. He then advanced it to 24. And he said each of those 24 components has between 13 and 15 variations. Mathematician did the calculation and said the variations in the golf swing based on Homer Kelly's calculations means that there are 486 quadrillion variations to the golf swing. So to deal with the complexity of the golf swing, golfers must definitely change their thinking. And the problem basically lies with golfers who manage their golf swing by trying to manage actions. That does not work. Golfers have to manage the interactions that occur in the components of the swing. What matters most in the golf swing, Fred, are not the components taken separately. It's the interactions, it's the product, not the sum, it's the product of these interactions, multiple interactions. And these interactions actually occur. Some are visual, some are not. Some are hidden forces and pressures that exist within the body. So swing is very relative. It's relative to the golfer himself, herself. So it's not what I'm suggesting here. What golfers, most important takeaway from this interview is that golfers need to focus on actions, but not on actions, but on interactions.
And we're going to get deeper into this. I'm finding it so fascinating, and the book hooked me from the preface. And so we're going to talk more about that. The book is called Your Inner Golf Guru, Developing the Golf Instructor Within, with Dr. James Ragonet, and we will be back right after this.
Fred, you asked before about guru, a strange title for a book based on science. You're entirely correct. But there are many books with guru in the title, so I don't want my book to be confused with the others. Other books extol themselves as the guru, the person who pervades truth and facilitates the improvement of others. That's not my approach. My approach is pupil-centered, learning-centered. It's based on the golfer destroying his own darkness and ignorance. Guru in Sanskrit is broken down into two words, gu, G-U, and R-U. R-U means destroy, like in ruin, and gu means darkness. So my book is about destroying your own darkness.
Ah, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of the book that I was getting is that there's a systemic approach to golf instruction and an analytic approach, or not even instruction, to the golf swing, a systemic approach and an analytic approach to the golf swing. Based on what I understood in the book, and it was, I don't want to say it's a academic book, but it is scientific. But what I was getting out of this is that recently I've been having my own personal struggles on the golf course, and I think it's because I'm trying to break down too many elements. I think I'm being too analytical. At least my eyes are opening to this based on what I'm reading from your book, is taking the holistic or systematic approach to the entire effort of hitting a golf ball versus picking on your wrist here and your left knee there. And am I missing the point, or am I getting there?
You're right on target. Einstein famously wrote that you can't solve a problem using the same mode of thinking that you used when you created the problem. And what's happening is golfers are using analytical thinking. Linear thinking means going from A to B. Einstein also wrote, logic will take you from A to B. Imagination will take you everywhere. So golfers, in order to improve, have to first understand what a system is. A system is an indivisible whole. It's a whole consisting of two or more component parts that affect the outcome and the properties of the system itself. The human body is a system. A car is a system. The golf swing is a system. Once you take a system apart, let's say if you look at a cow as a simple animal and you cut it up, you have different chunks of meat. But if you look at the cow as a milk-producing system, you can't cut it up, because if you cut it up, the parts of the cow will no longer function. When you analyze the system, not only does the system lose its properties, but so do all of its component parts. It's a self-defeating process. The difference between analysis and synthesis or systems thinking is very important. And the first step in analysis, you take something and you break it apart. Like if you handed a kid not an infant, but an 8-year-old kid fire truck. What he's going to do, he's going to take the little fireman out. It's going to take the hat off the fireman. He's going to take the hoses, the reels, the axes, and what? He's going to take it apart, and he's going to put it back together again. That's the first step in synthesis. The second step, second step in analysis, Fred, is you look at what each of those things, the function of each of those things taken separately. If you look at the fire truck, you look at what the axe does, you look at what the fire truck does, you look at what the reels do and the hose do. And the third step in analysis, you take all the things that you took apart from the fire truck and you put it back together again. Synthesis or synthetic thinking or systems theory, it's very different. Systems theory works this way. The first step in systems theory, Fred, is you don't go down, you go up. For example, with a fire truck, for example, what is a fire truck? The first step in synthesis, you look at the containing system that the fire truck is contained in. So it's a vehicle for putting out fires, or it's part of the transportation system. A college is part of the education system. Golf swing is part of a dynamic athletic motion. So you go up, you find out what the swing is a part of, a subsystem of, and you go up to it. The second step in synthesis is you look at what are the key properties of that containing system. What are the main properties of a dynamic athletic motion that lasts for 1.4 seconds. It's a complex muscular motor activity. Second step. The third step in synthesis, you take a look at the parts, backswing, downswing, pivot, and so on, and you apply the properties of the containing system and you see how they fit in. That may seem complex. Let me illustrate it. If you look at the pivot, for example, the pivot is Mo Norman and others say the pivot is extremely important, maybe one of the most important things. And if you look at the pivot and you just look at it separately and not how it's integrated, holistic, and part of the interconnected part of the swing, you'll miss it. I don't know if you've seen Trump swing a golf club. His hips move and he rotates his body and his pivot is all wrong because his head moves off the ball. If you move off the ball, you have to bring your head back to the ball. And you only have 0.4 seconds in your backswing and your downswing to do that. It's not enough time. I'm talking about timing here. Mm-hmm. So in a system, in an athletic system, there's a recent article I read by a guy named Daniel Lieberman. He's an evolutionary biologist at Harvard. And he analyzed, quite curiously, because he's a marathon runner, he analyzed the stability of the head when one runs. How does the head stay still, not walking but running, when your arms are swinging back and forth? How does the head remain stabilized? And he said, cursorial species, animals that run, namely deer and dogs, humans and others, horses, they have a thing, an anatomical ligament in the back of their neck. It's called a nuchal ligament, nuchal, N-U-C-H-A-L, nuchal ligament. And what it does, it attaches the back of your skull to your C7 vertebrae, so your head stays still. So if you're a zebra or a marathon runner, you can stay still. Golfers also have this nuchal ligament. And what I'm trying to say is, if you want to understand the golf swing, you have to go outside the containing system in order to understand it. The answers are not lying within. So if you want to keep your head still, you have to change your pivot because you have this special ligament strapped to your back of your neck that attaches you that keeps your head stable. And that's what you need to do. You have to swing, your head stays still, and you swing. Your head is like a bell. There's a headstock, and you just swing the coccyx back and forth like a bell. A bell has shoulders, has a waist, has a rim. So you keep your head still and you slide back and forth. The only way you can do, you can swing a club, and this is what Mike Austin called a compound pivot. It's not the only way to swing, but it's the most logical, unified, systemic way to swing a golf club by keeping your head still. So you move your body, your waist, your dirt, you rock your shoulders. When you see a bell being rung, Fred, the bell doesn't rotate the way your hips do in a golf swing. Your waist and your pelvis, they don't rotate. They tilt back and forth. And that's the way the golf swing has to work. It's systemic.
Fascinating. We're going to take another quick break. I have more questions about that. We'll be right back. So, James, I'm a little lost in the fact that we're talking about keeping your head still as an analytical part, as an element of the golf swing. Or is that is that like holding the whole
package
together?
Nothing works in a system, Fred. No component exists in isolation.
Right.
The property of a system is all parts have, no part in a system has an independent, isolated, and separate role. Mm-hmm. They're interrelated. So the head, this nuchal ligament, is attached to your spine. Your spine is attached to your hips and your knees and your ankles. All of it play a part. So the pivot is a unified, holistic movement. It's part of a systemic golf swing. You can't just look, what I'm saying is, you can't just look at the pivot and separate it from the golf swing. In no system can you take a system apart. If you take a system apart, it loses its essential properties. Let's do a mind experiment, for example. Let's imagine, I read in again in the New York Times not too long ago, there are 451 different types of automobiles, makes and models. Let's do this experiment, like Galileo, a mind experiment. Let's imagine that you bring all of these 457 automobiles, makes and models, into a gigantic hangar. And then you hire 250 of the best automotive engineers, mechanical engineers. And you hand them a clipboard and you say, I want you gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to look at all these vehicles, all 457, and identify which one has the best engine, which one has the best brakes, which one has the best windshield wipers, which has the best hubcaps, lug nuts, fuel pump, upholstery. And after you determine that, I want you to take all of those parts, remove them from those selected automobiles, line them up, the best of all those vehicles. And I want you to then take those elements and I want you to put them back together and form the best vehicle possible. You know what happened?
They came up with a Tesla.
No. You don't have an
automobile. No.
You don't have an automobile. You know why? Because the parts don't fit.
Oh. The fuel pump. Standardized.
You can't take a Rolls-Royce fuel pump and put it in your monkey shit brown Hyundai and expect it to work.
Hey, leave my Hyundai out of this.
That's what golfers are doing. Your golf swing is relative to you. It's a fingerprint, or it's like your signature. When Einstein famously said that things are relative, he's talking about the movement of time and space. And he said, your sense of time is a function of the speed at which you're traveling. Without getting too complicated here, golf is also relative to each individual. It's relative. In other words, a golf swing is relative. You just can't pick up a book, Hogan's Five Modern Principles, and expect it to work because you're not Hogan. You don't have his sensibilities. You don't have his reflexes. You don't have his coordination. You don't have a central nervous system. You don't have his body. He had very strong hands. Ted Williams said he had the strongest hands of anyone he's ever shaken hands with.
Wow. From Ted Williams, no less.
So Hogan was unique. And to pattern yourself on Hogan is ridiculous. If you wanted to go for a, if you needed a, or someone you know needed a kidney, you just couldn't go out and find the healthiest person in your neighborhood who had the best kidney you could find, because that kidney may not fit, may not connect with the person who needs it. And the same thing with golf. Your swing is relativistic. It's relativistic to a lot of things. It's also relativistic, which brings us to discussion of your learning, to your learning habits. If you have impoverished learning habits, if you can't concentrate, if you have a mental bandwidth to understand, to this book will require some self-study, but I think it'll be worth it. But things don't happen all by themselves. You have to apply yourself. And so things are relative to many, many variables. And one of those variables is your learning habits, your thinking habits, especially your thinking habits. Because most golfers are walking around convinced they got it all in one sock. They don't know that they don't know. They know enough to maybe get by, but they don't know enough to know that they're wrong. One of my heroes is a guy named Richard Feynman. He was instrumental, Cal Poly engineer, and he came to the forefront in the news when he looked at the Challenger explosion. And he looked at the systemic structure of the Challenger when it exploded on the launch pad. And it's an oddity, but what he said was, the reason the Challenger exploded, said it's a function of systems thinking. The rubber gaskets that held the booster rockets together froze overnight. Temperatures in Cape Kennedy dropped to, I think, below 25 degrees. And these hardened rubber gaskets snapped. And he said that explains why that thing, or that Challenger exploded. But what I'm getting to with Feynman said, Feynman's whole theory about science was he went about science not to certify and confirm what he already knew. That's the opposite. Feynman went about his business by trying to prove that what he knew was wrong. He took doubt. He exercised and nourished doubt. Certainty will get you only so far. Doubt will take you a long way down the road. doubt is what will take you down Sesame Street farther than you can ever imagine to go. Because once you're certain, things end. You can't be certain. Mm. You should always be discovering. Your brain should be like a hobby and say, okay, what can I prove? When I played golf every day for many, many years. And I'd go out and I'd shoot like a mid-70s. Then I go out the next day and I'd shoot a mid-80. And my friends would say, what happened? And I said, nothing happened. I just didn't like what happened. No, I just changed stuff. I wanted to find out. I figured, okay, that's 73 or whatever, based on luck. And I bounced off a tree. I landed within 3 feet of the green and I got a birdie. That should never have happened. So I said, but I did something wrong. I need to fix it. But golfers who are complacent and don't think about thinking will continue to make the same recurring mistakes. And I think what I've learned the most in this book, the research I've done in this book, deals with the interactions of all the components in the swing. And what I used to do, Actually, Fred, when I looked at swing, I tried everything. I looked at Jim McClain's, the eight-step swing, the square-to-square swing, like Altman. I looked at the Mo Norman's natural swing. I looked at Hogan's swing. I looked at Mann's model swing. I looked at Ian Byron. I looked at his swing, even though the machine was only one stanchion, one leg. And I tried all of them, natural Mo Norman swing. And I realized one thing after a decade of frustration. I felt like I was carrying Rosie O'Connell on my back after she just finished competing in a pie-eating contest. I just felt so burdened that I couldn't get to the bottom of it, particularly I was playing it competitively. It was such a burden. And I realized that finally, which gave Genesis his book, it's not any one of these things that has a specific flaw. It's not it. All of these approaches, every single one of them has the same common flaw. Golfers who invoke analytical, linear, reductionistic thinking are not looking at the swing holistically. You can't take it apart. It's a unified, dynamic, singular 1.4-second motion, and it has to be treated that way.
We need to break that down, and we will. Now, I mentioned earlier that we brought your first episode back on Golf Smarter Mulligans to episode 30. So if you want to hear about golf's three noble truths, please check that out. But this is what's coming up this week on Golf Smarter Mulligans. Starting this week on Golf Smarter Mulligans and continuing over the next 9 episodes, we're going to be replaying some of our many conversations with Tony Manzoni. Tony was a great friend of the podcast and an amazing golf instructor who passed away in 2018. We first met him in 2009, and in the dozen or so times he was on the podcast, emails flooded in with more positive feedback and success stories than any other teacher featured. So unless you're new to Golf Smarter or didn't play on the record-breaking Southern California College of the Desert golf team anytime between 1994 and 2017, you've probably never heard of Tony because we were one of the few media outlets to pay attention to him. The Orange County Register called Tony a living legend based on his coaching successes. We replayed some of these episodes last year, and I still get emails today reporting on how well you connected and improved using Tony's teaching methods. Tony's book, The Lost Fundamental, One Simple Move, Better Golf Forever, which was out of print when he passed away, is once again available on Amazon, including a Kindle format. Tony's video of the same name was also out of circulation, but can now be seen online. If you'd like to gain access, please write to me at golfsmarterpodcast@gmail.com, or of course, click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com. Lastly, after he passed, we created a Tony Manzoni Memorial Golf Smarter Fund to benefit the First Tee of Coachella Valley. Your tax-deductible contributions are greatly appreciated. Find out more at golfsmarter.com/Tony. Here's a sample of what you're going to hear in the first of 9 episodes. In this one, he talks about the lost letters of Ben Hogan that he found.
I had a fellow walk in my office and tell me, would you like a copy of a letter that Ben Hogan wrote explaining how to hit the driver? He had some private film that he had taken, and no one had actually seen a Ben Hogan swing. And I almost jumped in his lap. The first thing I noticed was that Hogan, on the top of the backswing, his weight shifts to the instep of his left foot. And when I read it, I thought, well, I think he means the instep of his right foot. And then I watched the film, and it was very obvious that he was staying on his left side 60-40 throughout the backswing. And I think when you really center your head to the golf ball, you must be a little bit more on the left side than the right side. I noticed that his right hip was aligned on the inside of his right foot. And I just noticed that when he swung, he rotated his shoulders around his spine, and his shoulders really were more level than his earlier swings. And the film that I had was after the accident. And that's really when he said, I'm going to start playing off the left side.
That's episode 98 of Golf Smarter Mulligans, featuring our first entry to Spring Forward with Manzoni. 9 consecutive episodes with the most popular teacher ever featured on our podcast, Tony Manzoni. Both Golf Smarter and Golf Smarter Mulligans are free and available wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe to both, and when you do, you'll be notified immediately when a brand new episode of either has downloaded to your favorite listening device. James, this seems to be somewhat of a radical approach to golf instruction, because when you take lessons from a PGA professional or not, meaning if you take lessons from someone who's not a PGA professional, they're going to work on the nuances. They're going to work on all the separate parts. They're even going to send you video of different golfers. It's like, you should do this with your backswing, and you should do this on your follow through, and all these different elements. And you're saying that's not really helping.
I'm saying two things at once. I'm saying you need to merge analytical thinking. You have to look at the parts. But when you have a lesson with a pro, you want to say, okay, what is my right elbow doing in the golf swing? But you don't ask him to solve your problem by fixing your right elbow. You need to ask him, how is my right elbow connected to everything else in my holistic swing that's making this glitch happen? When you have a system, Fred, there are two kinds of systems, linear and complex. Linear system is fairly easy to fix. It's like a conveyor belt in a cookie factory. Cookies roll along, the belt comes off, and you see immediately, we got to put the belt back on the rollers and get those cookies moving. But not all systems are linear or simple. Many are complex. Golf swing is complex. Golf swing is more like a nuclear reactor on a submarine than it is like a conveyor belt in a cookie factory. Here's why. Because the golf swing as a system is referred to as a tightly coupled system. In other words, the things that are connected so intricately that one glitch, one small error in a system will disable it. That's what makes golf so difficult. So if you have a golf swing, a complicated golf swing with all these different components of accumulators and pressure points and everything else that Homer Kelly talks about, all it takes in a golf swing. That's how my scores were variable for so many years. I would change one thing and it changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
If you change one thing in your anatomy, your diet, if you change like one small thing in your diet, for example, one small organ in your body works incorrectly, an adrenal gland or a kidney or something, because the kidneys don't exist in isolation, nor does the adrenal gland, everything is dependent on everything else. That's the nature of the system. The golf swing, everything is dependent on everything else. No part of the golf swing exists in isolation. So when you go for a lesson from a pro, you don't say, fix my problem. That's not what I would ask. And most of the lessons I've seen, when I've been given lessons, I'm on the practice tee, and the golf pro would come out and he would tell the same thing to 4 or 5 different pupils throughout the afternoon. They all had the same problem. But problem,
it's not possible.
Not problem. The problem he had was his analytical mode of thinking was flawed, severely flawed. Basically, Fred, your mode of thinking is predicated on a set of assumptions. That's what forms your universe, those assumptions. And most people assume that if you look at the cause, you'll directly see the effect, that cause and effect relate. But in complexity theory, that's not true. Cause and effect go out the window. Here are a couple of examples. NASA built a shed to build its rockets. It's 3.6 million square feet. It covers 8 acres. It's high and it's long and wide. Why'd they build it? They built it because they wanted to protect these rockets during assembly and during launch from the weather. You know what happened? It got worse. The weather pattern in that area in Florida, the Cape Kennedy, was so affected by this massive structure they designed to keep, to shield these rockets, that it brought more precipitation into the area than it had otherwise. Another example is New York City, 15 years ago, had a they had a notion that they wanted to have rent control so that people below the poverty line, or at the poverty line, could have sufficient housing. You know what happened? It made the shortage worse. Why? Because developers did not want to create properties that low-salaried people would occupy and destroy, so they backed off. They had rent control, but they didn't have the properties of the development to sustain it. Another good example is the hospital. 20% of the people who go to a hospital, they get something fixed, wind up more seriously ill or dead. You think going to the hospital is the cause and the effect would follow, but it doesn't. Complexity theory tells us that cause and effect are no longer linear. There was a psychologist, turn of the century, 1898. His name was Edgar Arthur Smith. He was a colleague of William James, who was the father of psychology. And this man remarkably came up with a new way of looking at the world. He's not saying that cause and effect relationships don't exist in golf or anything else, but he says a new way of looking at it. He said another way to look at a system is to look at producer and product. And he used the example of an acorn. If someone asks you, will an acorn produce an oak tree? What would you say?
Yes.
Okay. Not necessarily. If you take an acorn and you plant it in a snowbank, it's not going to grow. If you toss it into the sea, it's not going to grow. So what Smith said, Edgar Arthur Smith, he said, you have to look at it as an acorn, he said, is necessary to grow an oak tree, but it's not sufficient. To grow an oak tree, you need moisture, you need sunlight, you need a soil that's nutrient rich, and you'll have an oak tree. If you dug up an oak tree and found an acorn, that acorn was a function of a system that included many variables, sunlight, moisture, and, soil nutrients.
I'm curious, James, how has, and I'm not saying the collective PGA, but PGA professionals, teaching professionals, how, you know, this is kind of going against their, how they make a living, teaching professionals. How do they respond to your approach of the systemic approach versus the analytical?
Well, may I tell you a story to explain that, to answer that question?
Of course.
In 1950, Ernest Jones wrote a book called Swinging into Golf. It was published in 1946. Famous. He was a mentor for some very, very famous golfers, Horton Smith and many others, people who went on, men and women golfers alike. So in 1950, the PGA invited him to give the keynote speech, which he gave, got a standing ovation, And he basically, well, he was giving 3,000 lessons a year. His colleagues, fellow instructors, were giving 400 or 500. So he was giving 3,000 to their 300, 10 times as many, because he was producing, he simplified everything. So when the keynote speech ended, the host, after the round of applause, thanked him, shook his hand, and he said, "Unfortunately, Ernest, we will not be able to invoke any of the principles you outlined here today. Because if we did, these PGA professionals would start."
Wow.
So, unenlightened, I send my book, I won't mention who, to a person who has an established website, a PGA member, who has produced winners on the tour. And in fact, when I wrote the first book, he invited me to join his staff. Well, the second book, I sent it to him, and he snubbed me, sent him a book, never said anything about it. The only one who has not stuck an ice pick in this book is Justin Tang, which I sent you. Justin Tang is a credentialed instructor, world famous instructor. He works in the U.S., but he has clinics and an academy in Singapore. He said, "This is the golf book of the decade."
Wow.
He said it would be the golf book of the decade. I won't qualify that, except it doesn't have illustrations. If it had illustrations, it would be golf book of the decade. But he said, "This book is phenomenal." But he said, "Golfers who are less attuned need some illustrations." Well, here's what I say to that. I thanked him for his praise, and I reminded him that when Harvey Pinnock published The Little Red Book, there were no illustrations. 20 years later, the anniversary, 20th anniversary edition, they included illustrations. But his book had no illustrations.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can't imagine you putting any in. I mean, the only chapter, and they're short chapters, which is great, is that mentions any body part is basically the educated hands chapter. Everything else goes into other detail. But I think that testimonial right there about the book of the decade is a great spot to say the name of the book again is Your Inner Golf Guru, Developing the Golf Instructor Within, by James Raganet, PhD. It's RAGONNET. And I will include a link to that. It's available on Amazon. I will include a link to that in today's show notes. Thank you, James.
Thank you, Fred.
Great talking to you.
Nice talking to you. Take care.
Yeah, I hope I'm not boring you with these updates on my experience playing single length irons from oneirongolf.com, but your messages are clearly showing interest on how these perform. So, after the last two rounds since we spoke last week, I'm still kind of struggling with my distances on each club. I've created a spreadsheet that I put next to my my scorecard, and every time I pull out one of these irons, I've made columns, whether I'm playing a par 3, 4, or 5, what the distance is, my goal, the distance that I am from the pin, which club I'm playing, and then my total yards after I've hit the club. And then I make a note if it's a chip or a bunker shot or if the wind's in my face or something, and then I give myself a grade. So here's what I'm coming up with. Now, I've put 8 clubs between 23 degrees and 51 degrees in my bag. So far, I'm averaging 165 yards with the 23 degree and 94 yards with the 51 degree. So it should be fairly consistent and logical that every club would progress in 10-yard increments based on those numbers. But that's not been the case. Although it's kind of close. Now, the four clubs on the outside, the 23 degree and the 27 degree, and then on the other end, the 47 degree and the 51 degree, are pretty much there. But the big issue so far are the four clubs in the middle. Now, with this math, I should hit the 31 degree 145 yards, but in my four rounds so far, I'm averaging under 130. The 35 degree hasn't even come out of my bag yet. And the 39 degree, which according to these numbers should be 125 yards, I'm not hitting it over 100 yards. Again, I must say, these clubs are beautiful and the thicker grips are a pleasure to play. But unless I get to the consistency that I was experiencing with my Ping G irons, they won't be around forever. Just saying. But it's really fun to try out and share it with you, and I appreciate your feedback. And if you have any ideas of what to do about those four clubs in the middle, I'm happy to listen. Up next, we're going to hear once again from the wedge guy, Terry Kaler, and his latest venture into creating the perfect wedge for the non-professional golfer. We'll hear all about his new line of Edison wedges at edisonwedges.com, why wedges have lagged behind in technological advances where putters, drivers, woods, and irons have all developed significantly over the last 30 years. And he reminds us that the major club manufacturers don't design wedges for us. They're clearly designed for the professionals who can do a lot more with their clubs than we can even imagine. He's always opinionated, controversial, and very interesting, so don't miss that one next week. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions on what you'd like to hear on an upcoming interview, or maybe some suggestions on what I should be doing with my clubs, I'd love to hear from you. Use @GolfSmarter on social media, subscribe to Golf Smarter TV on YouTube, or just click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.